This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, I have a very special guest, Professor Robert Castor from Princeton, and he is going to do something really unusual on talk radio. He's actually going to read us a poem in Latin. So I'm really excited to have him. He's an expert on Rome, and he wrote a delightful book called The Appian Way. And I am so excited to have him because his book, which is The Appian Way, Ghost Road, Queen of Roads, it's a book that I really enjoy because my husband and I did that tour, the Appian Way from Rome to Brindisi on our honeymoon. And so it's going to be fun to talk to Professor Castor about his book. And then I want to remind everyone that on Thursday, I have a new author, Brooke Allen, who has written also, this must be the season for Rome. Well, it is, because it's coming up to on April 21st is Rome's birthday. So Thursday, I have Brooke Allen, and she's going to be talking to us about her new book called Antonius, Son of Rome. And that's very exciting for me because, again, it's a subject that I've always loved. I studied Latin in high school. It was my favorite class. And it was actually the only class where I had a really great teacher other than my chemistry teacher. But I never got in trouble with her because she liked me very much. My chemistry teacher, I did do in those days, you know, we did these horrible things in chemistry class, and I did get in trouble sometimes. But it was fun, and those were the days. Today you can't do stink bombs, or they'll call in hazmat or something. But in those days we had lots of fun in chemistry class. So, but anyway, I love Latin, and I'm always interested in talking to people about Latin and about Rome and about Italy. And so I'm really excited to have Brooke Allen on Thursday. I'm just waiting. I'm just getting a call right now on David Baldacci. It's always so exciting. I think this is like his eighth or ninth visit to Joy on Paper. So it's really exciting for me to have him on the program because he's so prolific. I don't know. He always has something coming out. I get to talk to him frequently, which is the most wonderful thing, to be able to talk to somebody whose books you admire so much and that I don't have to wait a long time between books because he is so prolific. And it's really always an exciting thing for me to get his books. I get so excited when I get them in the mail. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, David Baldacci. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, well, great. You know, it's always fun. I always get so excited when I get your books, you know, and I was thinking the other day, you know, you are, your publisher, of course, sends me this note saying, you know, remember, David is a global best-selling author, but I was wondering, does that cover the space station, or are you're almost like intergalactic, right? They have to come find a new word. Because
it sounds like it should.
I mean,
I should be up in the space station.
Oh, I am sure. If I was stuck up in the space station, I would have your. You know, you're wonderful because if somebody said you can only take one author with you, you know, one author, everyone would pick you because you have so many wonderful books. I mean, it's not like one series. You know, it's nice if you say one author, you take Tolstoy or something. Nah. I wouldn't even take Tolstoy. I'd say, I want David Baldacci. My goodness. I have all these wonderful series. Of course, we just interviewed you a few months ago for Vega Jane. But then you have John Pooler, who I love. I love that series. Will Roby. And then, and the new one, Atlee Pine. You know, that... I hope you're working on another one of that one because I love that you introduce a strong female. Woo! This is exciting. But I tell you, Amos Decker is my favorite. Of all of them, I just love this one. I love Amos Decker. I just relate to him so well. And I was thinking, I had a Zen moment when I started reading the new book, Redemption. I was reading the first page, and suddenly I felt like calm. I said, like, I'm home with Amos. I so feel with this guy. So I can see him in my mind, the way his body moves. He's a hulking big guy, you know, 6'5". But there's something about the way you write him that is so, it just immersive. I really feel like I can see him just the way he moves. And in the first page, you just bring him back to life.
Well, thank you. I enjoy writing his character a lot. I seem to channel him pretty easily. And every time I revisit him, I learn new things about him, and the character continues to evolve. And if he's not the favorite, he's certainly right up there as far as my characters. And he's just so different and so quirky, and I love writing the guy.
Oh, he's fascinating. Well, why don't you tell people about a little bit about him? Although my listeners, I'm always talking about you. But tell us about how Amos, his special, unique abilities, which for me are very fascinating, because I have a little bit of that where I'm able to see books that, and pages of books that I've read in the past. So tell us about Amos.
Right. He was a college football player, and he played very briefly in the pros. And on a one play on the field, he was blindsided in a really vicious tackle that, you know, nearly killed him. And he suffered a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, and he came out of his coma with a condition called hyperthymesia, which is perfect recall. Now he can't forget anything, and it's not just changed his memory ability, gave him sort of the superpower. It also changed his personality. He had been outgoing and friendly and gregarious, and now he was sort of aloof and maybe on the spectrum, very socially inept, and really had a hard time connecting with people. And so it changed who he was. He became a detective, police officer, then a detective, and his memory was a great attribute to have. And he's used it, you know, really well in solving cases. He can remember things and inconsistencies and contradictions and things like that, and things that he's seen is imprinted on his mind. In the first novel, he called it his DVR. He would just dial up his DVR. I updated his lingo to now he refers to it as his personal cloud.
Yeah, I love that. When I got to that, I thought, oh, that's exactly right.
So in Redemption, he's back in his hometown of Burlington, Ohio, and he's visiting the cemetery where his wife and daughter are buried, and would have been his daughter's birthday. So he's there laying flowers and visiting them with his friend Alex Jameson, who's now, since the last book and this one, she's become a full-fledged FBI agent, fully credentialed with her badge and gun. So a guy walks out of the tree line at the cemetery and approaches. He's an older guy. And he comes over to Amos Decker, and Amos doesn't recognize him, but when the guy says his name, he does. His name is Merle Hawkins. He was the very first person Decker ever arrested for murder when Decker was a homicide detective, rookie homicide detective. And Hawkins is there for a very special reason. He's out of prison now for reasons that will be revealed in the novel, but he tells Decker, issues a challenge. He said, you got it wrong all the way back then. I was innocent, and now I'm giving you a second chance to get it right and prove me innocent and prove that you were wrong. And so he lays down the gauntlet for Decker. And some people would have said, you know, hey, you were convicted, I'm done, I'm not going to look at this again. But Decker's not like that. So he ends up investigating his own case as a cold case, which is really unusual. Most cold cases are done by a different set of investigators. So Decker has to go back over everything he did to see if he did actually make a mistake and if Merle Hawkins really was innocent.
Well, it is one of these books that, it starts off, and as I said, we right away get this feeling for Amos, and we really care about Amos. And I've always, the minute you introduced, you know, Allison to the story, I thought, whoa, I like this character. And now, you know, when you come out with these books, how did you already have? Did you have the ending in mind? Because you're putting little clues in there, little things, right. You know, hints of what's happening, and it's really a fast-paced read, you know?
I you know, I didn't know the ending of the novel before I sat down to write it. I worked my way towards that. And, you know, you go back and edit and you put little things in, little Easter eggs, they call it, foreshadowing in, to accommodate the ending you have come up with. So it really is a work in progress. But I worked my way to the end and, you know, sort of surprised myself with the ending as I got to it, which is a good thing. I always figure if I surprise myself, I'm going to shock everybody else. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it gives it a freshness. That's why I felt when I started the book, I thought, I was wondering if you, when you sat down to start, you know, when you start that first page, if you yourself had a sort of a moment of calm that you know this character so well, and he's just growing as you are developing him. It's a beautiful process. It's just lovely to see.
Yeah, for me, the series is a great opportunity to spend more time with the character and evolve and grow them. Over a series of books, opposed to only having one book opportunity to do that. So Amos was such a complex character, there's no way in the world I was going to be able to sort of exhaust his possibilities in one novel. This one is the fifth one, and I still feel like we have a lot of room to grow with him. So I'm looking forward to, you know, revisiting him again and writing another novel about him.
Oh, well, I'm sure, because he's a character that people find fascinating and want to continue on with him. And you'll be writing them till we go to Mars, and you're going to be there on all of our you know, the space missions, because it's what's wonderful about your books, and it's the same with John Puller, and you so develop the character so beautifully, and that ability to make us, when we come back to a character after we've read a couple of other books in between, you know, but we come back and we feel so comfortable. We feel, and I was trying to analyze it, I'm analyzing a little bit more than I used to, because I read so much, and I'm just so fascinated by the process of how an author can so immerse a reader into the world that they're creating that, first of all, we feel like, you know, we've missed him and we're back with him, but it's done really so subtly. You have some description of what he looks like, but somehow just with what you do, we have this feel of how he's moving, of how he, I feel like I can feel like when he's like leaning, or when his shoulder is, he's shrugging his shoulder. It's beautifully written.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of that comes from the small details and the nuances that aren't readily apparent, you know, when you're thinking about plot and all that, but are very necessary to write a compelling story. And I want to put readers in the moment. I want them to be able to visualize, you know, in their own minds what Deckard looks like, as you said, how he moves and how he walks through life. And those are just little details, and you have to take the time to, one, come up with what those details are, and then, two, find the best language to incorporate those details into the novel. Not that it doesn't, you know, interrupt the story flow, but feels natural. And that's just sweat equity, you know, that's the blood on the forehead when you're writing these things, and, you know, the hours and hours and hours every day you're sitting behind a desk massaging and tweaking and creating. And there's no other formula for it. There's no other way around it. You just have to work at it really hard and define the phrases and the words to put these compelling characters together, because a character is nothing more than just a little million little details glued together somehow. And how good and memorable the character is how good your glue is. That just takes a lot of work.
And it does. And then sometimes people will say, you know, it sounds easy to write a book. I particularly love when people say, I'll start with a kid's book. That those are real easy. And that's not the way it goes.
No.
but you know, it's sort of like some author said something like to the effect that a brain surgeon said to somebody, you know, I'm going to retire and become a novelist. And then a novelist said back to the brain surgeon, oh, I'm going to retire and become a brain surgeon. You know, it's like, excuse me, this is hard work. You don't understand sometimes. With the level that you write at, that ability to draw the characters, the reader into the characters, so that we really, I mean, we can have two years between books, but when we get back to it, and as I said, I had this Zen moment when I'm reading the first page and I realize, well, Amos has been with me all this time. He's somewhere in there in my head, and I'm so comfortable with him. And that comes from, as you say, work. It really, it's a craft, and it's writing is such a wonderful thing, isn't it? It really is a joy to see this, what happens on paper. You have the inspiration, you have the idea, but then you have to work at the craft of getting it just right. And you obviously get it just right a lot of times, because that's why you are a global or intergalactic, we're going to call you the intergalactic best-selling author.
There you go. I'm going to have T-shirts made up.
they're saying there's aliens around. If there are aliens, they're reading your books. Because they say, okay, we need something good to read. We have to learn about America. Burlington. What is this Burlington place? You know, they'll land in, they'll read your books in outer space somewhere, and they'll land in Burlington. They'll say, well, we know Burlington. thanks to David Baldacci, we know Burlington very well. We can walk around the streets. We can go to the American Grill. We know.
That's right.
Right?
They know it all.
They know it all. I'm telling you. I'm sure that, you know, they're saying that, you know, more and more people are spotting these aliens somewhere hovering around. So I have a feeling maybe they're going to be flying over Burlington, and Burlington's going to say, okay, well, thank you, David Baldacci. You know, we want tourists, but we didn't know, you know, a spaceship is going to land here. But well, it is. It's so compelling and so real that I think there must be.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think it's one, it's the writer feeling really comfortable with the character. And I think when the writer feels comfortable, he can write it in a way that other people innately feel comfortable too when they're reading about the character. And again, it's the little things, putting you in the scene. You know, I started the book with a cemetery because it's a very serene, very somber moment. And Decker's doing something that all of us do from time to time. We visit people that we've lost, and we pay respects to them and visit them. And so it's a very, you know, solemn moment in his time. And then to have, then all of a sudden have this, you know, stranger appear and lay down this very challenging, you know, proposition to Decker, takes you all of a sudden from somber back jarring to the real world. And it was almost like I was trying to set up a very quiet moment, which I did, and then sort of slap the reader in the face and say, yeah, but this is not going to last long. Go off in a whole new direction.
Oh, yeah.
Pay attention.
then we go too, like crazy. But it is, that cemetery scene is, I think that's why I got this zen feeling that there's calm. I'm feeling really into it, and I can see him sitting there, and I can feel the way his shoulders are, everything. And then, of course, you have like one sort of clue after another, one trail after another that we're going down, and you keep turning the pages because you want to know what's David Baldacci going to do to us next. We're gonna have a fun ride here. And so as I said, I love the Amos Decker series, and I'm glad to hear that you're working on the Atlee Pine, a new Atlee Pine book, because she was a new character that you introduced, and I really enjoy her.
No, I do too, and I'm working hard on that one. And again, she's a character that really intrigues me, and has brought some fresh challenges to me as a writer. And you know, she has her own baggage and demons in her past too, and she's going to be confronting them head on in the next novel. So I'm very excited about that. It's great to shift between these different, so different characters. You know, from Puller to Roby to Atlee Pine, Amos Decker. It keeps me on my toes, that's for sure.
And we can't forget Vega Jane, because that, I think that's a wonderful series, because
yes,
one of the things that we, you know, all of us want to do is try to get young people to get into books. And I was thinking, you know, I know that you started writing at a young age because your mother gave you a notebook and said, write.
Yeah. She said, you know, start writing some of this stuff down. And that was kind of like an epiphany for me, that I could turn stories into my head, into thoughts on paper that other people could read. And really, that's where it all started for me.
Well, and we're so lucky that there weren't any of these devices around for her to hand you one of these Game Boys where you're playing games. And
right.
No, really, I feel that we're losing a lot of kids that way, because they get into these repetitive games. I was at a restaurant and there's a family, all three kids, different ages, like 14, 10, and 7, or 6 or 7. And they're all playing on those devices, and they're all playing, and I sort of peeked over to see what they were playing. And as far as I'm concerned, they're stupid games. They're, over and over the same thing, just winning another little prize or something. And I thought, what a waste. I mean, even if the parents had given them crayons do one of those things in the restaurant, would have been better. And the parents were having a conversation, actually. And I was thinking, either you should be talking to the kids, you should be encouraging them to draw, paint, or like your mother, write a story, and get these devices out of their hands.
No, absolutely. I feel the same way. It's, we're getting out to communicate with each other and talk to people, which is an important personal skill to learn, particularly when you're growing up. And people need to interact with one another. And it's almost like, back in the 40s and 50s, everybody would go into a restaurant and everybody would pull out their cigarettes and smack them, on the table and then light up, and the whole room is full of smoke. And now it's like the smartphones and these devices are the, 21st century nicotine. Everybody goes in the restaurant, they pull out their phones and they sit down and they're just by themselves.
It's a shame, because when we were kids, in my family, there were three of us, and when we'd go to the restaurant, we would tease each other, but we'd have conversations. And my little brother, who was a little doll, would sometimes just stand up and start singing or dancing. He was like a little entertainer. We didn't know what he was. We thought, what is this kid? He's going to be on Broadway or something. But he always liked to, attract a crowd. So, but we had fun. It was nice. I remember these the times that we went to restaurants, because, we weren't rich. We didn't go often. But, it was nice, and I feel so sad for these kids, and that's why I'm so happy. I know that you and your wife are big supporters of giving books to kids.
Yes, we have. We fund literacy organizations and initiatives across the country. We also have a book collection effort, Feeding Body and Mind. On my book tours, we collect books from my fans and then send them on to food banks across the country. We've distributed millions of books in that method, and a lot of people who are food challenged and have to seek assistance at food banks often have lower literacy skills and probably not much money for books. So we're trying to fill up homes with books. I've seen, great results from books being in a home. I've seen terrible results from no books being in a home. Home is a place where there should be books, and kids should be able to read and see their parents reading, and a lot of good results come from that.
Absolutely. Well, I think you and Michelle are doing a great job with the Wish You Well Foundation and all the work that you're doing to encourage people to read and people to encourage their children to read, because it is so important. We need a generation of readers and people who can think and not just play silly games all day. So I think, you're doing a great job. But so what's the next book? I it's so much fun. I as I said, You come out with books often enough, I don't have to wait years to talk to you.
No, you don't. You won't have long to wait. I was started writing, when I was on book tour last year, I started writing a short story, a crime noir book set in the 40s. Now, I thought it was just going to be a short story, and then I really got obsessed with it, and it turned into a novel. It's called One Good Deed, and it comes out in July of this year, and it stars a guy named Aloysius Archer, who's a World War II vet, comes home, framed for a crime. He goes to prison for a few years, gets out, and has to serve his parole in a city, in a small city in the United States. And it turns out to be quite a place, and a lot of things happen to him. So it's a mystery thriller sort of set in the, it's a homage to like a Raymond Chandler type story. So that'll be the next one coming out for me.
Well, David Baldacci, I want to thank you so much for joining me on Joy on Paper today. I just celebrated the 4th anniversary of my program. And so it's...
Congratulations. That's fantastic.
Well, I'm having so much fun. And one of the most fun things that I get to talk to you often. And so I'm looking forward to July already to talk to our I'm going to crown you the intergalactic best-selling author. And again, thank you so much for joining me today.
Same. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye, David. Bye.
Bye.
Ooh, he's cool. Okay, we're going to have a commercial break, and then I am back with Professor Robert Castor. Wow, this is an exciting day.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back with my next guest. It was so much fun to talk to David Baldacci, and now I'm going to have so much fun talking to Professor Robert Castor. Hi, Bob, are you there?
I am certainly here.
Well, I'm being presumptuous, and I'm calling you Bob because I always wanted to call a professor by his first name, but I never had a professor that I liked. Enough anyway. So I'm so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper to talk about your book called The Appian Way, Ghost Road, Queen of Roads. And it is Culture of Trails, Adventures in Travel. It is a fun book. I want to tell you, when I got this book a while back, my husband and I, on our honeymoon, we did this tour from Rome to Brindisi. Actually, we started in northern Germany. We picked up our car that we sent from America to Bremen, Germany, and we picked up the car and we drove all the way through Europe and over to Austria, through Vienna, and then we, of course, got to Rome. And then I said, well, let's do the Appian Way. And my husband said, okay, where is it? And I said, well, I have this book because I do collect books. At one point I had 6,412 books. I had this book. It was written in 1920. I often did this. We went to Paris and I had a book written in like 1892, and I'm taking him around Paris following that book. But we got to Rome and I said, okay, we're going to go all the way. And so we did. We went all the way down and we went to Brindisi and then took a ferry over to Greece. So
when did you make that trip?
Oh, that's about 30 years ago.
About.
So, wow. When I got your book, it brought back all these wonderful memories. And of course, as I mentioned, when I got the book, I've always been interested in Rome, and Latin was my favorite subject. And then I thought, okay, I started the book, I read the first sentence, and I said, oh, I love this guy. He's a professor that I can love. So let's talk about your trip on the Appian Way. And A little bit background. Are you currently, or have you retired yet from Princeton?
I retired in the middle of last summer, but I'm still, the way we professors do, we can keep on working at what we want to work at, even after we retire. So
that's it. And what's your official title? What's a big fancy title for you?
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, I'm Professor of Classics Emeritus and Kennedy Foundation Professor of Latin Language and Literature Emeritus.
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's fantastic. Okay. I love having a professor here. I think I'm just going to keep inviting professors, and then finally I can get a good education. Because now you're going to tell us all about the Appian Way and where, what it means and who started it. And that's actually 2,330 years ago, right?
That's right. It was the first road ever built in Europe. And it was the first of many roads. By the time the Roman road system was completed, it had more miles than the U.S. interstate highway system now does.
Wow.
And it was one of the great accomplishments and one of the great things that the Romans left to us, the engineering that that was involved in the building. And I got involved in this project of writing the book because I was invited by the editor of the series, Culture Trails, published by the University of Chicago Press, invited to contribute something. And I thought about it for about 5 minutes, and then the phrase Via Appia, Appian Way, just sprang into my mind, and we were off from there.
Well, so tell us how it started. Tell us, you flew to Rome, and, tell us about the whole trip.
Right. We flew to Rome, and after we managed to get ourselves unjet-lagged, we started exploring the stretch of the road that leads southeast out of the city. There are about 9 miles of old roadway that have been excavated, uncovered, and it's possible to walk on the actual ancient stones with many, many ancient remains on either side of the roadway. The Romans did not bury their dead in the cities. They buried them outside the cities along the roads. So a road like the Appian Way would have been literally walled in by thousands of tombs extending miles and miles from the city. And for the most part, there's only their bases, their very scant remains that are still there. But walking along the road, walking under the wonderful pines that grow along the road on a quiet Sunday morning is a wonderful experience. And after we spent our time poking around the first 9 miles, we walked back and forth over that stretch at least two or three times, we decided that instead of driving south from Rome toward Brindisi as you did, that we'd take a train and get down to Brindisi and work our way back from Brindisi back toward Rome. And that was a very happy decision because it allowed us to spend time, much more time than we otherwise would have, in the southern part of Italy, in Apulia and Basilicata and Campania, the regions that a lot of American tourists never get to, because American tourism, understandably, is concentrated in Rome and northern Italy, because that's where the Renaissance happened. But the Renaissance didn't happen in the south, and the south is a land of huge farms and plantations and lovely people.
Yes, most people, if they head south of Rome, they head to Naples.
Yep,
and
exactly.
And of course Pompeii, and we did
right.
we did that side trip too. We went to Naples and we went to Pompeii, and then we headed back and did that whole road all the way down to Brindisi. But tell us a little bit, whose bright idea was this road? Because this was really a very bold and fantastic idea.
It was indeed, and it was both the road and the Rome's first aqueduct were the contribution, the work of one man, and his name was Appius Claudius Caecus, Appius Claudius the Blind. He became blind later in life, The way I might be known today as, you know, Bob Castor the Bald, after the unfortunate departure of my hair in later life. But he was a very very powerful, very influential Roman statesman belonging to a very noble family. And he was so pleased with his accomplishments, the road and the aqueduct, that he gave his name to them, Appius. And so the road became the Via Appia, the Appian Way, and the aqueduct became the Aqua Appia, the Appian Water. And he built built both at a time when Rome's power was expanding hugely on the Italian peninsula. You know, Rome began as a very small settlement about 10 miles from the Mediterranean Sea. And by the time Appius Claudius came around in the late 4th century B.C., around 320 B.C., Rome's power had extended pretty much all the way down the Italian peninsula to the southernmost reaches. And the fact that the road was built at that time was a direct consequence of Rome's expanding power, because when you have a large army, you have to move it, and moving an army by ships is more difficult than moving it by land over a well-made road. So the building the road from Rome to Capua, 120 miles southeast of Rome, was the first stage, and gradually over the course of 40 years, the road was extended all the way down to Brindisi, about 350 miles.
So it took how many years altogether?
About 40 years.
About 40 years, which is interesting because we have a road here in my area called Ulmerton. It's about 20 miles long, 25. They've been building that thing for 10 years, and they still haven't finished it.
Well, they should get a time machine, get back in touch with the Romans.
I often think of it when I'm stuck there on that road where it's a six-lane road down to one lane because they're still under construction, and I think of the Via Appia. I say, where in the world is Appius Claudius when we need him? Because he could have done this. You know,
he could have done it.
Yeah.
And he could have done it without dynamite. You know, there were no explosives, there were no heavy machines, but yet moving, doing the excavation needed to build the road, moving all the material out, and then moving the paving material and the paving stones back in, meant moving the equivalent of about four times the Great Pyramid at Giza. 12 and a half million cubic feet of material, using nothing but muscles and animals and sweat.
Because the terrain in some areas is unbelievable, difficult.
It's mostly elevated. That's right. There's very little flat ground, and building the road into the mountains meant having to terrace the mountains, cut huge parts of the mountains away, in order to achieve a level foundation for the road.
Now, I forgot to mention that the car that my husband and I brought from America was a white Cadillac, which was funny, of course, going through Europe in general. So in many places, we had to, you know, park somewhere and then walk in, or, you know, because of course we couldn't be driving on most of that road with that car,
right.
But it was fun. But when you went and you walked to certain areas, the terrain, you're in awe. How did they do it? I mean, it is really, in some ways, there are some places that are really scary. You think, how did they do that?
How did they do that, right? Well, unfortunately, they did it using slave labor. Rome was a slave society, and it could not have existed as it did, could not have achieved all that it did without the what we regard as the very unfortunate fact that human beings bought and sold other human beings for just that purpose.
Oh, now, when you were, we forgot to mention who you were traveling with, because like I was traveling with my delightful husband, you were traveling with your own companion, right?
My delightful wife, that's right.
That's right. So, what did she think about this whole adventure when you said, oh, dear, we're heading to the Appian way.
She thought it was a wonderful idea. She's not only a great sport, she's also a great traveler. And she has accompanied me on virtually all the travels that I've made in my teaching and lecturing career. And whenever I'm say, working in the Vatican Library, she's in Rome with me, but she is out exploring the city on her own and having a great time on her own. And it was wonderful on this particular trip, having her perspective, because, you know, I came to it with certain preconceptions about who the Romans were and why they did what they did. But she was just a fountain of questions about, when did this happen? Why did this happen? Who did it? And made the trip far more stimulating than it would have been if I had just done it on my own.
And did you have some adventures along the way?
Well, you mentioned your big Cadillac that you were not able to take into some of the historical centers of Italian cities, and that made me think immediately of the worst or the funniest experience that we had. We had a small rental car, and we were driving into the historical center of the city of Venosa, small Italian town, middle of the peninsula, the home of the great Roman poet Horace. And there was a statue in the middle of the city that I really wanted to see. So we kept driving in, and the road was getting progressively narrower and narrower. And my wife was saying, Bob, maybe we should stop. Or Robert, I think we've gone far enough. Or Rob, this does not look good. And then, you know, when she goes from Bob to Robert to Rob, I know I'm getting in deeper and deeper. Long story short, I went too far, drove smack into a large stair step that was built out into the roadway, and managed to back out with the help of a very kind and friendly native of the town. And then we sat out on the road to our next stop, and this car got up to speed about 20, 25 miles an hour and started making the most horrible noise. It sounded like a bull bellowing. And I pulled over to the side and got out and saw that the right front wheel was about 45 degrees off off the angle that it should have been on, or that it was resting at an angle of about 45 degrees. So we drove as far as the lovely town of Melfi, where we had to stop and make some quick calls to American Express and try to find out how to turn this unfortunately now crippled car in and find a new one. But it was not, as I said, not the most pleasant of experiences, but it gave us a chance to get to know the people of this small Italian town, who were unbelievably kind and hospitable. And added an element to the trip that otherwise we wouldn't have had. So, you know, I'm not sure I would say that I'm glad that I did what I did, but it was one of those lucky accidents.
Well, these things happen, and sometimes they are so wonderful, because we also had a problem with our car, and we were, as some people would say, stuck in Livorno. But it was one of the best side trips we ever had. We met so many people because, you know, for a Cadillac, we needed a part. Some little part. Now, of course, in Italy, you do not really find these parts for a Cadillac. So luckily, we got to Livorno, and there is an American base there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and so my husband, left me in Livorno to, you know, tour around the city myself, and he went off to the American base and, of course, gets all involved with all the soldiers, and they find somewhere in their supply depot, they find just the part we need so that we can continue on south. But meanwhile, we had two lovely days there where we stayed in a really a little pension kind of place, and the most delightful people, a restaurant that, like, you know, just a real mama papa restaurant. It was lovely, and we had interacted with the people, and it was so much fun. So those, you don't, you just, all of these little side things that happen make for for the fun part of a trip.
And that's really true. It was the different interactions we had with so many people along the way that was not just the most unexpected part of the trip, but just simply the most warm and human aspect.
Because in the south of Italy, they don't get that many tourists compared to you know, the other parts, and so they do react differently, and we always found them so wonderful, so kind, and we'd be sitting out there in trattorias and cafes and just having so much fun. And that's why I wanted to bring people, to make people aware of your book. First of all, I love the cover. I just love that cover. It's so, I don't know who did it for you, but it's so nice. It's it's just so attractive with the mosaic. I just thought it was so cute.
Vespa.
A mosaic Vespa. I told you now, I'm going to have to write a book about our honeymoon, and I'm going to do a mosaic Cadillac. That'll be cool, huh? The book is called The Appian Way, Ghost Road, Queen of Roads. And it's a little book, but you have so much in there. You have all the history that we need, plus these little stories along the way. And at the back, you have resources, you know, things that people can, either books that people can read to get sort of in the spirit of things. And I think it's a wonderful, I like these, taking these tours to other places instead of just the big cities. And you learn so much. And like one of the recommendations you have in there is Stephen Saylor's Murder on the Appian Way, which is a wonderful book to start, or the series really to start the just getting a feel for that whole area.
I can't speak too highly about Stephen Saylor. He knows the material. He's a wonderful writer, and it really gives the feel of imagining what ancient Rome was like.
And I just love all the recommendations you have in there and all the suggestions you have. You know, for people who are looking for something different, what the nice thing is there is a lot of walking that you can do, and that's really great to, you know, not just be always in a tour bus or something. It's to get out there and actually physically walk some of this area. It takes you to a different era. You know, you go with the way, for example, that you write in here, and you talk about the historical aspects like Cicero and all of this, that we start to imagine it. And of course, the pine trees, so many people don't understand the pine trees of Italy are so different from those in America.
Yes, and the pine cones are so different. The softball-sized pine cones, they're quite remarkable.
It is, and that's the kind of thing that you don't get if you're just in a tour bus or in the city.
Exactly.
You have to be out there and walking and having picnics along the way and, you know, wine and bread and just reading your book, because it is fun, because there is so much history that has occurred on that road. It's just unbelievable, you know, what we've, of course, for many people, many Americans, they have fathers or grandfathers who actually were in World War II.
Sure.
And so have a connection. Tell us about where World War II history fits in on the Appian Way.
It doesn't so much, because the main battle sites in Italy don't happen to coincide with the Appian Way, but there's plenty of other military history that lies along the Appian Way, and if someone is a history buff or a military history buff, they can follow the road and imagine Spartacus.
Oh.
Using the road as he would have when he revolted in 71 BC, Capua which is was the center of Roman gladiatorial training, and probably the home of the original gladiatorial combat.
I have to stop you. I have to stop. You're going to read a poem for us in Latin.
Oh, yes.
Do it.
Yes.
Because I don't have much time.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Okay. Go for it.
It's a poem by the Roman poet Catullus, as he is about to leave the province of what is now northern Turkey. And he is looking forward to getting home. So here's what he says. Iam ver e gilidos refert tapores, iam caeli furor aequinoctialis, iucundis seferi celescet aures. Linquantur frigii catulla campi, nicae quager uber aes duosae, ad claras asiae volemus urbes, iam mens prae trepidans avet vergari, iam laeti studio pedes vigescunt. O dulces comitum valeta coitus, longe quos simul ad domo profectos diversae varie viae reportant. Like a translation?
Oh, no, we don't have time. But, you know, okay. I'm going to have you back, actually. That's so beautiful. You read it so beautifully.
Thank you.
Yeah, we just made history. I think that's the first time anybody on radio has done a Latin poem. And you have a wonderful voice for it. So, you know, maybe we could have you back and we can talk more, okay?
Love that.
I really appreciate you joining me today, Professor Robert Castor. Oh! I think it's just so wonderful to talk to a professor. So, Bob, again, thank you for joining me today. And I really appreciate it. And I love your reading.
I'm very grateful. And I really enjoy talking with you, Patsy.
Okay. And everybody, you can find The Appian Way at Amazon. Get it. And why not take a trip and have some fun and follow Bob Castor. Okay? Bye-bye okay. Now.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Isn't that nice? I had a real professor reading doesn't he read beautifully? Wow, I could listen to that for a long time. So I think maybe I will have him back and he can read us some more Latin. Oh, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in an audible book. Oh, my goodness, to even have Latin read to you. My goodness, isn't that wonderful? I'm so thrilled with that poem. Wow. Anyway, remember that this is one of the joys, really, of just being around people who love to read, love to write. Bob Castor's book is fun. If you're not ready to make the trip, get the book, read it, and just, you know, it takes you away. The history is fantastic. All you need to know about that time period and about Italy, and you will just want to do it. It's something to add to your joy list, those places that you want to go and those things that you want to do in the future. And don't put it off and just start enjoying your life and start writing. And who knows, you'll come up with a wonderful book like Professor Castor's The Appian Way. And again, I want to thank David Baldacci, too, because he is so wonderful. And I'm looking forward to July already because he's going to have a new book. Isn't it exciting? To be a writer and to just learn your craft and make people happy. And anyway, go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper, and I have my fourth anniversary interview there with Tasha Alexander and Andrew Grant. It's a wonderful interview. I had so much fun talking to them. So go to my webpage. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. He's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And bye-bye, everybody.